few centuries before Christ, Alexander the Great conquered almost the entire known world at that time with his military strength, his cleverness, as well as diplomacy that he used. One day, Alexander and a small company of soldiers approached a strongly defended walled city. And back then, a city without a wall was defenseless. And so the cities would create these huge walls to be able to defend themselves. And Alexander, standing outside the walls, raised his voice and demanded to talk with the king. The king came to the top of the wall above the invading army, looking down, and agreed to hear what Alexander had to say. "Surrender to me immediately," commanded Alexander, to which the king laughed and called down, "Why should I surrender to you? We have you far outnumbered. You are no threat to us." Ready to answer the challenge, Alexander replied, "Allow me to demonstrate why you should surrender to me." He then ordered all of his men to line up in single file and start marching. And he marched them straight towards a sheer cliff that dropped hundreds of feet down to the rocks. The king and his soldiers watched in shock, disbelief, as one by one, Alexander's soldiers marched without hesitation right off the cliff to their deaths. After 10 soldiers had died, Alexander then ordered his men to stop and to then to return to his side. Realizing that nothing would stop the eventual victory of men who were absolutely obedient to their leader, so much so that they would be actually willing to give their lives for him, the king surrendered to Alexander. Now, not that I personally agree with all of Alexander's methods, especially if you're one of the first 10 in line. But you know, every time I think about wholehearted obedience, this illustration always comes to my mind. Wholehearted obedience, regardless of the cost. You see, this is the kind of obedience that we are to have towards our leader, the Lord Jesus Christ. That's the kind of obedience that He calls us to. But not only calls us to, this is the kind of obedience that He Himself modeled for us. He is the supreme example of perfect obedience. And that's what we're going to be looking at this morning. Now, having shown the greatness of Jesus' high priestly ministry, by contrasting this with the ministry of the Levitical high priest back in chapter 14 and verse 14 through 16. Chapter 4, verses 14 through 16, the author of Hebrews now is going to reveal to us Christ's superior qualifications for this office of high priest. So first of all, he begins talking about how Christ is superior to Aaron and all the Levitical high priests by showing and contrasting the two ministries. In chapter 4, verses 14 through 16, and now as we come to Hebrews chapter 5, the author goes on to reveal his superior qualifications for this office. If you have your Bibles, turn there with me if you would. In Hebrews chapter 5, verses 1 through 10, this morning, I want us to look at two lists of identical qualifications, whereby Jesus Christ is compared and He's contrasted with the Jewish high priest and shown how Christ has fulfilled and even superseded all of the qualifications that were there for the priests of Israel. Now, again, as we go through this, even though it's talking about the high priest of Israel and how that's contrasted with Jesus Christ, who is the great high priest and the perfect high priest, I believe as we go through this, we're going to see that there's a lot of principles that we need to apply to our own lives. Now, the first list of qualifications is for what I call the earthly high priests. The earthly high priests. In verses 1 through 4, we're going to be looking at four basic qualifications for a Jewish high priest that are listed here. Now, the first qualification is this: his genuine humanity. The first qualification to be a high priest in Israel was to have genuine humanity. Look at the first part of verse 1. For every high priest taken from among men. Let's stop there. In order to be a high priest in Israel, one had to be taken from among men. In other words, he had to be a man. He had to be a human being. God did not choose angels to serve as priests, only men. And again, we've already seen how Christ is superior to the angels. But we're not talking about angels here. We're talking about how he's superior to Aaron and to Aaron's descendants. Again, the Levitical priests. As we saw last time, these men can only be the descendants of Aaron, of the tribe of Levi. Those are the ones that God reached down and picked out, chose to be priests, those that would serve in the tabernacle. Now, whereas the priests were the official ministers in the nation of Israel, the high priest was considered the highest religious authority. So here we see the first qualification of a high priest, of an earthly high priest, is his genuine humanity. The second qualification is his, what I call, representative offerings. His representative offerings. Look again at verse 1. For every high priest taken from among men is appointed on behalf of men in things pertaining to God in order to offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. As a man, the high priest ministered on behalf of men, or as the people's representative before God. Again, we're talking something totally different than what we now enjoy as Christians. Back then, the high priest alone could come into the very presence of God. Because of Jesus Christ, anybody can. Since man's core problem is his relationship with a holy God, and that basic problem is because of sin, the things pertaining to God here that the high priest primarily dealt with was offerings for gifts and sacrifices for sins to God on behalf of the people. Because sin was the problem, the high priest would represent them and bring gifts and offerings to God on behalf of the people to deal with their sin problem. The very existence of a priesthood and a system of sacrifices in the theocratic nation of Israel. Again, remember, Israel was not a democracy. Israel was a theocracy. God was the one that they were to look to. That's why the tabernacle and then the temple was the center focus of the nation. And therefore, the high priest was the most important person. And the existence of a priesthood and system of sacrifices in the nation gave evidence to man's estrangement from God. But it was an act of grace on God's part that that God instituted the whole Levitical sacrificial system by which sacrifices could be made, because we're told without the shedding of blood, there is no remission of sins. And therefore, the sacrifices were made that atonement could take place for people. All of the sacrifices, day in and day out, year after year, were under the high priest's direction. That's what he was responsible for. But as we saw last time, once a year on the Day of Atonement, it was he alone that would enter behind the veil into the very Holy of Holies to sprinkle the blood of atonement on the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant to symbolically atone for the sins of the whole nation. The offerings that the high priest offered to God as the people's representative. Notice here that they're called gifts and sacrifices. Now, gifts were usually voluntary grain offerings for thanksgiving and dedication, whereas sacrifices had to do with those bloody offerings for sin's atonement. Whatever, whether it be a bird or a bull or a goat or whatever, again, there was an animal that was slain. The blood was offered. However, since the words gifts is used, as we will see in chapter 8, verse 4, to refer to all of the various sacrifices. When it says gifts and offer and sacrifices here, there should be no distinction made between these. And the words for sin should be taken for both. Therefore, again, these are the sacrifices for sins. Whether they be gifts or sacrifices, they are for the people's sins. And this is what the high priest, as their representative, offered before God on their behalf. Therefore, the high priest was primarily concerned with the problem of human sinfulness and the people's need for reconciliation with God. We come now to the third qualification, which is his sympathetic gentleness. His sympathetic gentleness. Look at verses 2 and 3. He can deal gently with the ignorant and misguided, since he himself also is beset with weaknesses, and because of it, he is obligated to offer sacrifices for sins. As for the people, so also for himself. You see, the earthly high priest not only represented sinners before God, but he also needed to be able to deal gently with those sinners. Which we see here called the ignorant and misguided. It speaks of those who are without proper understanding of God's truth, of His law, of what He has laid down for us to do. And by sinning, they have wandered away from it. They ignorantly went astray. And again, there are all kinds of sins that people commit. And then various sacrifices were given for each sin. But it's important to understand that God had no provision but judgment for those who committed the intentional high-handed sin of rebellion. We're told in various places, in Exodus as well as Numbers, where if they commit a certain sin in that category, they were either to be put to death or cut off from the people. Now, to deal gently with sinners speaks of having a compassionate, non-judgmental, sympathetic gentleness about you, towards those who are sinning. You see, such a quality avoids the emotional extremes of how many times we deal with sin. It's either apathy or indifference on the one hand, or harshness and disgust on the other when someone sins. The high priest was not to condone people's sin. He wasn't just to condone it, to let it go, to be apathetic and indifferent about it. But he also wasn't to be harsh and just disgusted by what took place in a way that communicated that he was above it. How in the world could you ever do that? see, the sympathetic gentleness of a good high priest flowed out of a deep awareness of two realities about himself. First of all, his own personal weakness. You see, look what it says here. He himself also is beset with weakness. The person who is unaware of their own weakness will come across very harsh, very judgmental. The high priest was to have a balance between leniency and severity, between encouragement and rebuke. But he wouldn't be able to do that if he was not aware of his own weakness in that area. Again, he was no different than those who he represented and served. He shared their same human weakness, their same frailties and infirmities and limitations. But along with that weakness, he also shared a second, his own personal sin. Look what it goes on to say. He is obligated to offer sacrifices for sins. As for the people, so also for himself. See, the high priest had a sin nature just like everyone else did. This is why on the Day of Atonement, before killing the goat of the sin offering on behalf of the people, to then go and sprinkle that on the mercy seat in the Holy of Holies, the first thing that he had to do with the blood of a bullock that he offered for himself was to take care of his own sin and the sin of his household. He had to do that first. He had to offer a bull and take that blood and present that before the Lord. So he would be okay and his household would be okay. Before then, he would go in and represent the people and make sacrifice for them. You know, I believe this is why a self-righteous, holier-than-thou attitude that looks down on others when they do wrong flows out of an ignorance, an unawareness of the depth of sin in one person's own heart. Like the high priest, only by recognizing our own sin will we be able to sympathetically be gentle towards other people who are in sin. Remember what Jesus said in Matthew 7 about taking the log beam out of our own eye before we can help others take the speck out of their eye. He doesn't say don't do it. He just says deal with yourself first. The same way in Galatians 6, where it talks about those who are spiritual coming alongside of those who have stumbled, but to first of all, take a look at yourself. So when you do that, you do it in gentleness. Again, these are principles that we can learn. Homer Kent Jr. accurately states, here lay one of the weaknesses of the Aaronic system or the Levitical system that's underneath the high priest Aaron. The priest himself needed a priest. A further weakness was that sinfulness in the priest often prevented him from being perfectly sensitive or aware of the needs of others. End quote. So the second qualification had to do with his sympathetic gentleness. But again, because he was a man, because he was a sinner, he needed to address himself. But because he was a sinner, many times he wasn't as sympathetic as he needed to be. My mind goes to remember Hannah, as on Mother's Day we like to kind of go through the story of Hannah many times. And we see how Eli the priest, when Hannah was there pouring her heart out to the Lord, Eli was so disconnected and insensitive that he actually said that she was drunk when she was praying to the Lord and said that she was a worthless woman, when in reality, she was a woman that was of excellence. The fourth qualification of the earthly priest, the high priest, is his divine appointment. Look at verse 4. And no one takes the honor to himself, but receives it when he is called by God, even as Aaron was. No man could legitimately appoint himself high priest. And to try to do so was a sign of arrogance and selfish ambition. In verse 1, we saw that the high priest is appointed. He is appointed on behalf of men. The word appointed here is in the passive voice, which speaks about if someone is appointed, then someone else did that for them. It's something that is outside yourself. The action has taken place upon you. You didn't do the action. And so we see the high priest here was not to appoint himself. As we come to verse 4, we see who that is that appoints him. He is called by God, even as Aaron was. Which should bring us a deep sense of humility, not pride. If I did something to accomplish that, again, the temptation would be pride. But if this is something that is given to you, that you're appointed, you're called by God, there's nothing in you that brings that about. Then see, it leaves us with a deep sense of humility. And that's the attitude the high priest was to have. John MacArthur says about this, the use of the present tense in these verses would seem to indicate that the Levitical system still was being practiced at the time of this epistle. Again, the book of Hebrews was written right before AD 70. In AD 70, again, that's when Titus, the Roman general, came in and did what? He destroyed Jerusalem as well as the temple. At that point, the Levitical sacrificial system was gone. It's been gone since then. When the priestly system was established under Moses, God called and appointed Aaron, Moses' brother, as the first high priest. And all succeeding high priests were to not only to be Levites, but also descendants of Aaron. Any exceptions to this required the explicit command of God. Such is the case of Samuel in 1 Samuel chapter 16. Again, Samuel was not a descendant of Aaron, and therefore should not have been a priest. And yet God did something unique. God himself did that. But apart from that, those who ever attempted to attain this honored position on their own received God's judgment. For example, when Korah and his fellow rebels, Dathan and Abiram, tried to make themselves priests, the Lord caused the earth to what? Open up, and he swallowed all of them. The earth opened up and swallowed them. And then he closed it up on them. Again, judgment. This was God's doing. They were chosen by God, called by God. No one was to do this, grab this position on their own. When King Saul, a Benjamite, impatiently assumed Samuel's priestly role, God took away his kingdom and he gave it to another. And that's when David was given the kingdom. When Uzziah, king of Judah, intruded into the temple to try to burn incense, the priest tried to stop him. But he did it anyway, and God smote him with leprosy. And he had leprosy for the rest of his life. Again, this is given by God. It is a divine appointment, not by man. No genuine priest ever elevated himself to the high priestly office. All were sovereignly chosen by God. So these are the four qualifications of the earthly priest. We come now to the second set of qualifications, which is for the eternal high priest. The eternal high priest. In verses 5 through 10, the author of Hebrews now shows how Jesus fulfilled and he superseded these four qualifications, although he gives them in different order. The first is this: Christ was divinely appointed. Whereas that was the fourth, now this is the first concerning the eternal high priest. Look at verses 5 and 6. So also Christ did not glorify himself so as to become a high priest. But he who said to him, "You are my son, today I have begotten you." Just as he says also in another passage, "You are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek." Now, Jesus Christ did not assume the office of high priest by his own initiative. He didn't just say, "I'm it." The official title, Christ, meaning Messiah or anointed one, in itself affirms the fact of his divine appointment. But the author here proves this in the rest of these verses. Notice that he says, he, speaking of God the Father, who said to him, Christ, which again corresponds to the statement in verse 4 that a high priest was called by God. He, God the Father, said to God the Son, "This is what you're going to be." So we see that divine appointment. But the author goes on to quote two passages from the Psalms as proof that Christ's high priestly ministry is clearly not from himself, but from God. Now, again, where is he going with all this? Why is this so important? What difference does it make whether he is the high priest or not? We're going to get there. But see, he's building towards that. This is the qualification of an earthly high priest. But this is the eternal high priest, Jesus Christ. And he not only met those qualifications, but he superseded them. Look at the first quotation here from the Psalms. The first one here is from Psalm 2, verse 7, which we already saw cited back in chapter 1 and verse 5 that demonstrates Christ's sonship. Says, "You are my son, today I have begotten you." Now in this passage, God the Father addresses the Messiah, Jesus, in his capacity as the duly installed and authoritative messianic king. "You are my son." Again, Psalm 2, it's dealing with the messianic kingship of Christ as the Son of God. He acknowledges him as my son. See, no Jewish high priest ever was described like this. The second quotation is from Psalm 110, verse 4, where he says, "You are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek." And notice how God addresses the Messiah, Jesus, and calls him a priest forever. That is his eternal priesthood. Here we see that one of the important functions of the Messiah King, Jesus, is his eternal priesthood. So in these two passages, we see that he is a king, as the son, and a priest. And whereas the Levitical priest belonged to the order of Aaron, Christ's eternal priesthood, look what he says, is according to the order of Aaron. Of Melchizedek. Well, who in the world is he? Who's Melchizedek? We see him back in Genesis chapter 14, verses 18 through 20, where he is called the King of Salem, as well as a priest of God Most High. Here, Melchizedek is a king and a priest. He's both. Melchizedek was during the time of Abraham. You see, in the Levitical system, the offices of the king and the priest were totally different. They were carefully distinguished and allotted to different tribes. You see, it was only the tribe of Levi that had the priests. And only of the family of Aaron could be that. However, since Melchizedek was a king and a priest, these two quotations fully substantiate Christ's qualifications as a Melchizedek type of priest. You see, the Messiah is both a king and a priest forever. This is the eternal high priest. He is a king and he is a priest, like Melchizedek. His royal priesthood is by divine appointment. He didn't make himself that. God the Father did, which reveals how he is superior to Aaron and the Levitical priesthood. Then second, Christ is genuinely human. He is genuinely human. This is just seen in the first part of verse 7, where it says, in the days of his flesh. In the days of his flesh. When the author speaks of Christ's flesh here, he's referring to the human nature that he took to himself in his incarnation. The phrase, in the days of his flesh, designates the period during which the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Jesus was a real person. Just as the high priest had to be a man, a human being, Jesus was fully man. We've already seen in chapter 2, verses 14 through 17, as well as last time in chapter 4, verse 15, that he had a real human nature, just like us, with the only exception being that he did not have sin. He was without sin. He didn't have a sin nature. He was the God-man, 100% God, 100% man, without a diminishing or a mixture of his divine and human natures. It was only because Jesus identified himself completely with us as a man that he was able to fulfill the next two qualifications. And I'll give you those, both the third and the fourth. Christ is sympathetically gentle. He is sympathetically gentle. And he is our representative offering. He doesn't present representative offerings. He is our representative offering. I put these together because as we go through verses 7 through 10, these are so intertwined, it's hard to pick them out. Look again at verse 7. In the days of his flesh, he offered up both prayers and supplications with loud crying and tears to the one able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his piety. Now, throughout his time on earth, Jesus maintained constant fellowship with the Father and expressed his total dependence on him by means of prayer. As you go through the Gospels, you see him always going to different places, getting by himself to pray. However, the situation here that is talked about, where he offered up both prayers and supplications with loud crying and with tears, is no doubt the time of Jesus' agonizing prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane. That's the example that the author of Hebrews is putting out here before us. Although in his humanity, because of what lay before him, Jesus was extremely tempted to abandon his messianic mission and prayed fervently, so much so that Luke 22:44 says that his sweat became like drops of blood that was falling down upon the ground. He was fervent in his prayer. The impact, the weight of what lay before him was so heavy, and he was agonizing so much that, again, his sweat became as blood. I think it's because of this that many people see that what is happening, they attribute his distress to merely the fear of a painful execution. But I believe that's woefully inadequate. Jesus clearly knew the reason for which he came. Jesus came to die. He came to die. He came to die. And that was the supreme purpose of his incarnation. When God became man, he came to go to the cross. He knew that. He was to be the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. The cross was the fulfillment of his mission. And he moved onward to it with an inflexible determination. We're told that he set his face like flint towards Jerusalem, knowing that that's where he was going to die. Therefore, the agony of Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane was due to something much greater than merely the fear of physical death, as horrific as that is. And as we've discussed that at different times during the Easter time, you know, in the crucifixion and how that actually happened and the way the body responded to that and what the Romans did and the crucifying of a criminal. Again, it was horrifying. And yet his agony was far more than just physical pain of death. It was because he would take upon himself the holy wrath of God that was poured out against sin that we deserved. And he would experience for the very first time, and only time since eternity past, separation from his Father. That is what the agony was. 2 Corinthians 5:21 says, He, God the Father, made Him, God the Son, who knew no sin. He was sinless. He was without sin. Who knew no sin, to be sin on our behalf, so that we might become the righteousness of God in Him. As I said many times, what a deal. What a deal. Jesus endured the penalty of our hell, that we might experience the pleasure of his heaven. What a deal. See, this is why he prayed with loud crying and tears in the Garden of Gethsemane, knowing what lay before him, that he would be made sin for us. And in that moment, the Father would turn away from him. This is why he cried out on the cross in Matthew 27:46, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus' sacrifice on our behalf was himself. As our representative, as our substitute, he didn't offer sacrifices. He was the sacrifice. He is our representative offering. Jesus' sacrifice differed in three significant ways from the Jewish high priest. First of all, his sacrifice, as I said, was not of produce or birds or animals. It was him. Second, he didn't have to make a sacrifice for himself like they did when they went into the Holy of Holies once a year. Again, he was sinless. And third, his sacrifice was once for all time. And having resurrected and ascended to heaven, he sat down at the right hand of the Father on high. Never true with the high priest, who continually, day after day, year after year, had to offer more sacrifices and more sacrifices. Could not sit down in the Holy of Holies. Needed to go in there, pour the blood on the mercy seat, and then get out until next time or next year, the same time. Jesus' sacrifice was once and for all times. Notice that Christ's prayers and supplication at Gethsemane here were offered to the one able to save him from death. Now, obviously, this doesn't mean that God the Father would save him from physical death. That's not what he was praying. He knew why he came to die. So that's not what it's talking about here. Because the Father did not save him from physical death. If he would not have gone and died in our place, we would not have salvation. Therefore, this prayer is that his Father would save him out of death, in the sense of raising him from the dead. He would be saved out of death. It's a prayer about his resurrection, which Jesus had prophesied that he would die, that he would be buried in 3 days, rise again. Notice that the author goes on to say, and he was heard because of his piety. The word piety here refers to Christ's reverent dependence on God, his total submission to the will of the Father. This is seen most clearly in the garden when Jesus prayed in the midst of his turmoil, in the midst of his agony. In Luke chapter 2, verse 42, Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me. Yet not my will, but your will be done. See, that's total submission. Knowing what lay ahead, he was willing to do whatever the Father's will was. And it was because of his piety, of Christ's total submission to his Father's will, that manifested itself in obedience. And his obedience, regardless of the cost, led him to experience the suffering of the cross. Look at verse 8. Although he was a son, he learned obedience from the things which he suffered. Just because he was the Son of God, God the Son, didn't mean that when he came and became a man, that life would be easy. He was granted no exemption from learning obedience, which comes through suffering. And Jesus didn't suffer in order to correct any disobedience in him, because he was sinless. He learned obedience by experiencing the suffering of death on the cross in order to confirm his humanity and also to experience its suffering to its fullest extent. Even as we saw when he was dealing with temptation, because there was no sin in him, he took the full force of temptation. So he has full sympathy with us when we're dealing with temptation and trials. Because a lot of times we lessen the force by yielding to temptation. He never yielded. He was sinless. And so he learned obedience by experiencing this suffering of death on the cross, to confirm not only that he was a man, he was human, but also to experience the suffering of humanity in its fullest extent, so that he would be the perfect sacrifice to take the place of sinners and be able to perfectly sympathize with us in all of our temptations, in all of our trials. Look at verse 9. And having been made perfect, he became to all those who obey him the source of eternal salvation, being designated by God as a high priest according to the order of Melchizedek. The Christ being made perfect doesn't mean that he was ever morally imperfect. But the word perfect here means complete. Complete in that he was completely equipped for his high priestly ministry by the sufferings he experienced that culminated at the cross. He was made complete, completely equipped to be our eternal and perfect high priest. Jesus victoriously endured all of his sufferings, which he dramatically declared by his triumphant utterance on the cross. It is finished. He declared triumphantly that he had endured everything, that he had accomplished why he came. And because of his perfect righteousness and because of his perfect obedience and sacrifice on our behalf, notice that he became to all those who obey him the source of eternal salvation. To obey Christ is to first of all believe in him. Jesus said in John 6:29, "This is the work of God, that you believe in him whom he has sent." And even the Apostle John said in 1 John 3:23, "This is his commandment, that we believe in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ." To obey his commands, to obey him, means to first of all believe in him. Again, John MacArthur states, and I quote, "True salvation evidences itself in obedience to Christ. From the initial obedience to the gospel command to repent and believe, to the life pattern of obedience to the Word," end quote. And because Jesus is the source of eternal salvation, there is no other way to God but through him. The author goes on to say about him in verse 10, "being designated by God as a high priest according to the order of Melchizedek." Again, referring back to Psalm 110, verse 4, the author shows how Christ is the eternal high priest who is called by God according to the order of Melchizedek. Again, he keeps hammering that in because the order of Melchizedek was far superior than the order of Aaron. Melchizedek was a king priest, where Aaron's line, the Levitical priesthood, could only be priest. Kingship was different, was in a different tribe. Now, the order of Melchizedek will be discussed in detail by the author in chapter 7. Therefore, because Christ fulfills and he supersedes all of the qualifications of the Jewish high priest, he is superior to Aaron. He's superior to the Levitical priesthood. His one perfect sacrifice accomplished what all of the priests put together could never do with their millions of sacrifices. And that was to bring people into the very presence of God. And because our perfect high priest has endured and perfectly obeyed the ultimate suffering of the cross for us, we need never doubt that he fully sympathizes with whatever we're going through. What are we going through today? What are we dealing with in our lives and our families? The Lord knows. He fully sympathizes with everything that we're going through. And he is there to help us to obey, regardless of the cost. Like he obeyed the Father, but on our part to do that, it will require commitment. It will require commitment. I think the application, at least to me, in this passage, that the Lord kept bringing back to me, is are you wholeheartedly committed? Are you wholeheartedly committed to obey Jesus as much as Alexander's soldiers were committed to obey him? We're talking apples and oranges here. Talking following a man versus following the one true living God, Jesus Christ. And yet for a man, his soldiers were willing to give even their life in obedience to what he said. And yet, where are we in our commitment to obey Jesus and what he tells us in his word, regardless of the cost? Are we committed to wholeheartedly obey him? We should be. We should be. You know, and if not, there's something seriously wrong in our relationship with him. You see, that was the problem. That was the problem with the recipients of this letter. And so the author will now come and address that problem, which we will see next time. Let's pray.